Welcome back to the Turbo Time podcast. I'm your host, Alyssa Maripodi, the managing editor of Turbo Machinery International. And today we are talking about pumping CO2 with MythBusters Klaus Brunn and Rainer Kurtz. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me again. I'm really looking forward to this discussion today.
Yeah, and thanks again for allowing us to talk about this really important topic. So I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, so in part two of this episode, we're going to talk about the impact of CO2 on centrifugal compressor performance and carbon sequestration. So to start, could you tell us how the pressure of CO2 in a pipeline, you know, for example, affects centrifugal compressor performance?
All right. So basically, the pressure of the pipeline could be anything, right? It could be just slightly above atmospheric. It could be a couple hundred PSI. It could be 1,000 PSI. And that impacts many things, right? It impacts the density of your fluid. So the denser the fluid, the more mass you're transporting. Ultimately, you want to transport mass. But the higher the pressure, also the thicker the walls of your pipeline will have to be, because basically you're going to have to contain that pressure. And so therefore, the more expensive your pipeline becomes. So the decision on what pressure you transport a fluid is a multivariable optimization exercise that ends up then telling you, okay, for a certain distance, for a certain type of gas, in this case, be it CO2, for a certain end pressure that I need, here's an optimal pressure. And it's not an easy exercise. It's a relatively complex exercise. So that's that point. From a consumption of power perspective, in the supercritical range, you're dealing mostly with compression. In the dense phase range, you're dealing with a fluid that's a lot more dense. And so your consumption per compression, and it's a little hard to say what per compression here means. It's really per energy transport, but CO2 doesn't have energy. So they call it mass transport. It requires less power in the dense phase. But again, the calculation is not that easy. There's many, many variables that play into this calculation.
I mean, to keep this very simple, CO2 is a gas, and we know how to compress it. Now it's a very heavy gas that imposes some challenges on the aerodynamic behavior of these machines. But again, this is not something new. The industry knows how to handle that. In fact, actually, CO2 is a very popular test gas when you do factory performance tests on gas compressors because of some of its features. The one part that is a bit tricky from a design standpoint is when you're in that supercritical phase close to the critical pressure and temperature, the density of the gas is very sensitive to temperature. In fact, actually, all the thermodynamic properties of the gas are very sensitive to things like temperature, to the point where relatively small temperature changes can move the operating point of the machine from the low flow side of a map very much to a high flow side of the map. But again, that is understood, is researched. It's an interesting topic, though.
Yeah, I mean, we've been building CO2 compressors for many years, and it's challenging to do it, but we know how to do it because the engineering for this exists, and there is currently commercially available compressors out in the market and pumps out in the market that can easily do these duties that we've been describing. The challenge in all of this is not that we don't know how to do this. The challenge is that there's an entire new infrastructure that needs to be built that doesn't currently exist, right? You now want to start transporting from many power plants, all power plants, I don't know. You want to start transporting massive amounts of CO2 to a geological formation, which means you're going to have to build compressor stations, You're going to have to build pipelines. You have to do injection stations. You have to go to CO2 treatment. There is a little bit of moisture that you need to deal with, and maybe other things in your CO2 that you'd have to deal with. So you have to have a separation of CO2 from your flue gas, or where we get your CO2 from. So all that infrastructure doesn't exist. And it's not something I can just say, I'm going to give you a compressor and in 6 months from now, it's there. Typical lead times on just compressors, for example, are floating between 18 and 24 months these days. And so and that's based on building capacity of the manufacturers in the world that can build this kind of compressor. There's not that many that can. And so we're talking 10, 15 years or so to build this infrastructure that would be required for more for CO2 compression.
Just one number for reference. In the US, they've built a 30 or 32 inch CO2 pipeline that's operating at about 2,200 pounds. So it's a supercritical or dense phase pipeline. In order to fill that pipeline with CO2, you need about somewhere in the ballpark 7 or 8 gigawatt worth of natural gas fired power plant. And obviously you would need half of that roughly as a coal fired plant. So you, in order to make these pipelines in a size where they're economic, you need to bundle a lot of CO2 generation. Again, if the task is to transport that over longer distances, the picture totally changes if you only need to transport the CO2 over short distances because your sequestration site is close by.
Yeah, and that's again brings up the discussion about existing versus new power plants. I mean, there's certainly some discussion in the industry now of trying to site power plants near to places where you can actually sequester. That doesn't mostly apply for existing power plants, which tend to be built at intersection points between, let's say, natural gas pipeline supply and a transmission line, right? So if you build a combined cycle plant 15, 20 years ago, what you were trying to do is find where is the pipeline where I can get gas and where the transmission line where I can sell my electricity into an urban or industrial setting. Now the third variable of this is where can I put my CO2 before you build a new fossil fuel type power plants. And again, the existing power plants are kind of there, they are where they are, and they're going to have to deal with whatever distance they have to transport. And some of them are going to get lucky in that they're close to a salt dome, and some of them are going to be 250 miles away and they'll have to deal with that.
Okay, so when you're talking about carbon sequestration challenges, how is the industry optimizing these technologies for emissions control, specifically in terms of gas leakage and losses?
Gas leakage is always an issue for any kind of gas, right? And so the industry has, over the last 50 years or so, has developed technology to really, really minimize leakage that comes from centrifugal compressors. And there's a thing called dry gas seals that provide very minimal leakage. That same technology that was really developed for natural gas and hydrocarbon transport is equally applicable to CO2. There are some challenges here. As I mentioned before, CO2, when it leaks too rapidly at a too high a pressure rate across into atmosphere, you could get dry ice formation. It could cause all kinds of havoc with your dry gas seal. But overall, these are things, again, that you can engineer around and that are understood. So the leakage issue has been, I wouldn't call it addressed, but has been dealt with for many, many years because it's the same issue that you're dealing with when you're dealing with hydrocarbon transport. Now, the efficiency issue is a different story because remember, your emissions that you, your energy consumption drive emissions, right? There's leakage and then there is emissions, which is based on energy consumption. So the challenge here is optimizing CO2 compression. And there is a lot of technology going on, but most of it has to do with what's called pass optimization. Basically, you're trying to develop a thermodynamic path of compression that requires the least amount of energy when you get from a certain pressure from atmospheric, let's say, to 2200 PSI. So over the last, I would say, 30 years, there's been quite a bit of work on that. There's been a lot of work by the U.S. Department of Energy. There have been a lot of work by manufacturers. A lot of that has to do with intercooling technologies that has to be improved. Some of it has to do with aerodynamics that has to be improved because CO2 is kind of a little bit of a weird gas. But there's been a significant amount of technology development on that side to reduce the power consumption of CO2 compressors. It's a very relevant area of work because, as I mentioned before, a power plant is intended to make power. You don't want to just use up all this power to just compress that gas or do whatever with. So you want to try to keep as much power as possible.
And let's go back to that leakage question. I mean, you can build a centrifugal compressor package that does not leak. Either by you can use a combination of dry gas seals and then capturing the emissions from the dry gas seals, but conceptually that is nothing new that exists, and that's actually one of the big advantages that centrifugal compressors have over other compression methods, that the leakage avoidance is relatively simple to accomplish. Now, having said that, there are a lot of other areas within the compression and capture process that are probably not that simple to accomplish, but it's not an unsolved technical problem. And the other thing is that on the efficiency, I just want to re-emphasize what Klaus said. You can certainly optimize impellers flow paths for compressing CO2. It's really not something that nobody has ever done before at the lower pressures. It is indeed a bit tricky when you get right above the dome, right into that supercritical areas, because the properties change so fast during your compression process. But again, the general problem is understood.
Yeah, the bigger challenge is almost a mechanical one, in that you're going to try to utilize as much intercooling in this process as possible. And this has to do with a particular thing of CO2 and other heavy gases, in that their thermodynamic performance is very pass dependent, meaning that it gives you a very high efficiency if you use what's called an isothermal compression pass, meaning a compression pass that is as close to a constant temperature pass. The only way to accomplish that is to intercool as much as possible continuously if you want. That's not possible. So it becomes a mechanical issue. You want to design a compressor that has a lot of intercooling between stages. And that's less of a research issue, but more of an engineering design issue, because it means there's a lot of passages, heat exchangers in and out, a lot of plumbing basically around a compressor. But it's all doable, and it has been done, and there is technology that does that, and it's certainly something that can be still further optimized, but we're doing pretty good. Now, Reiner did mention that this is a nice advantage of centrifugals over other compressors, and this doesn't just apply to CO2, it just applies in general, but other compressors, like, for example, reciprocating compressors, especially the ones that are running wet, will have significantly higher leakage. And that's why it's somewhat questionable if you want to use them, especially if you have larger flows, because the point of the CO2 sequestration system is not to leak the CO2, but it's actually to get the CO2 to where it's sequestered in the ground, right? So you really want to minimize leakage as much as possible, because otherwise you're defeating the purpose of your entire system.
So that ends, you know, the questions that I have, but is there something else you guys want to add about compressing or pumping CO2 that we didn't touch on?
No, I think this was a very good discussion. We covered a wide range of areas. The main point to make from my perspective is that the CO2 compression, and hydrogen compression for that matter, is technology that we know how to do. There's certainly room for improvement. It is primarily a question of adding infrastructure that doesn't exist at this point in time. And even if you wanted to add all the infrastructure that you wanted, the manufacturing capacity in the world doesn't exist to do it very rapidly. But from a technology perspective, it has its challenges. Hydrogen is a heavy gas, a light gas. CO2 is a very heavy gas, but these are issues can be addressed, and they're being discussed obviously in technical forums all the time.
Yeah, I think I can only second what Klaus just said. There are a number of refinement issues in as far as the technology goes, but from a compressor standpoint, these are not insurmountable. These are very much solvable with the engineering tools that we've developed over the years.
Okay, great, wonderful. Thank you both for joining me today and going over the CO2 pumping and compressing.
Thank you for having us. I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah, I really had fun. Thank you.
All right, and thank you to our audience for tuning in today. I'm your host, Alyssa Maripodi, and we will see you next time.